safe to compare St. Petersburg to a jewellery box, with its museums, bridges and cathedrals being some of its gems, then what we have in store for you today have to be the crown jewels, imperial treasures where time has stood still. Just outside of St. Petersburg, Tsarskoe Selo was once the summer retreat of Russian emperors. It's where history and imperial ambition blend seamlessly. It's most famous for its Amber Room, a masterpiece once lost, but then painstakingly restored. So let's step inside. Yulia, we know that the Amber Room was a gift from the Prussian king to Peter the Great. Was this simply a great display of generosity, or was there some other motive behind it?
It was, among other things, a question of prestige, as the Prussian king wanted to flaunt his wealth, but mainly it was a diplomatic gift. It had to do more with the establishment of an alliance between Russia and Prussia. In 1716, Peter the Great met Frederick William I in Havelberg and entered into an alliance against Sweden in the Great Northern War. The Prussian king wanted to seal the agreement by gifting the Amber Room.
Now, we know that the original Amber Room disappeared during World War II, and there are many theories as to what happened to it. Which one do you personally find the most convincing?
There are some 100 different versions about where it might be. Our museum doesn't favor any particular version. It could turn up anywhere, but most likely it remained in Germany.
Right.
Hidden somewhere, perhaps.
That's the simplest one, probably. There are also rumors that artifacts from the original Amber Room resurface now and again, mirrors, mosaics, etc. Do you think there's any truth to these rumors?
The last director of Königsberg Castle, art historian Dr. Alfred Rode, wanted the Amber Room to remain in its place of origin, where it was created. When the Red Army was approaching Königsberg, he divided the Amber Room into several parts. He was only interested in the original German part, which he hid in the basement of the Königsberg Castle, and which apparently still survives somewhere. As for the Russian part, which included the pieces created in Russia, it was of no interest to him. So he shipped it somewhere as a red herring to throw off those who might look for it. The mosaics, which we're going to see in the Amber Room, also remained in the Königsberg Castle and perished in the Königsberg Castle fire. So it's true that some pieces have surfaced in different parts of the world. But it doesn't mean they come from the original Amber Room, which I believe survived and is still hidden somewhere.
Now, there's also a darker mystery surrounding the Amber Room. It's said that those that go looking for it meet strange and tragic ends. What do you make of these stories, Yulia?
We know of at least 17 people who had something to do with the Amber Room, one way or another, and died under mysterious circumstances. It's true that there is a mystery that haunted those who tried to get to the bottom of the problem. Still, people keep looking for the Amber Room, and the enthusiasm is still there.
Right. And here we are, Yulia, in the great Amber Room of the Catherine Palace. And I can honestly say I've never been in a space quite like this one. Now, I've often heard of it being referred to as the eighth wonder of the world. And I'm not going to lie, I've heard many things being referred to as the eighth wonder of the world. What, in your opinion, makes this room worthy of that title?
I think the Amber Room is worthy of that title because it's unlike anything made before or after. Visitors get the impression of being inside a big and beautiful amber box. The best description of the Amber Room belongs to the French romantic poet Théophile Gautier, who visited Russia in 1857. Only in the Thousand and One Nights and in magic fairy tales, where the architecture of palaces is trusted to the magicians, spirits and genies, can one see rooms made of diamonds, rubies, jacinth and other jewels. The expression the Amber Room is not just a poetic hyperbole, but exact reality. An eye which is not used to seeing this material applied on such a scale is amazed and blinded by the wealth and warmth of these tints, representing all colors in the spectrum of yellow, from a smoky topaz to a light lemon.
Well, I couldn't have put it better myself. The Amber Room was a gift from one emperor to another. But why amber? It's hardly the most expensive of materials. Is it simply just because there was enough to fill an entire room?
It's a bit of an odd question. There was a country called East Prussia, and amber was one of its main sources of revenue. The amber industry there was established at the initiative and through the efforts of Frederick William, who just loved amber. His work culminated in the creation of the famous Amber Room, which Peter the Great coveted for himself as a major diplomatic gift.
Mm-hmm. Well, amber is often referred to as a living material. Is it difficult to work with, and does it degrade over time, for example, from UV light?
True, it's a challenging material. It's not a stone, it's an organic compound. As we all know, it's fossilized tree resin. Like any other natural material, it's difficult to work with. It has peculiarities. It's quite soft. It's very beautiful. However, artisans have always liked it. It lends itself easily to shaping and can acquire many different warm, cognac-like hues by means of thermal treatment or micronized dyes. It's a very exciting material.
Mm-hmm. Well, how did restorers even go about recreating the Amber Room, given the fact that the original was lost? What sources did they use? Photographs, sketches, memories?
It's an old story. It happened a long time ago when the Soviet Union was still around. The loss of the Amber Room during World War II was a symbolic loss of cultural heritage in general. Typically, when you set about restoring something, you need an object of restoration. But here we're really talking about recreation. The work began by studying documents.
Was every element of the original Amber Room faithfully restored, or could the restorers use a certain degree of artistic license?
The restorers didn't add anything themselves. Restoration is something that doesn't really have anything to do with artistic license. It's scientific reconstruction which was done in strict accordance with the project, which in turn was based on historical photographs. That's why we use the term scientific reconstruction.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's probably the only place in the world where you can see so much amber at once. Do we know how many kilograms were used?
We didn't count it in kilograms. The restoration of the Amber Room spanned a long period, about 25 years. Many things changed in that time, including the country's social system, amber prices and quality and so on. Roughly speaking, we estimate around 6 tons of amber was used.
Amazing. Would you say that the Amber Room today is just a reproduction of the original, or has it evolved into something else, into a work of art in its own right?
It's a difficult question. Of course, it's something new. It's something new. We tried hard to recreate the original, and there's substantial proof that our restoration was science-based. Let me share an interesting story. A few years ago, one of the 4 Florentine mosaics was found in Bremen, Germany. After many rounds of negotiations between our diplomats and their German counterparts, that mosaic eventually made its way to Tsarskoye Selo. We compared that 18th century mosaic from the original Amber Room with the one we'd created by then. It was a nerve-wracking moment. But when I saw the mosaic, I was greatly relieved because we matched the color and the technology almost to a T. I can tell you in all honesty that our work was not inferior.
Finally, Boris, we know that amber gradually changes colour over time. So could we say in 20, 50, 100 years, the amber room will look different than it does today?
Before the war, the original amber room was in a very poor condition, actually. It needed restoration, and our architects prepared a project. It had turned a darker colour because it had been treated with different kinds of oil. You should never do that. You can make it luminous and shiny for a while, but then it'll eventually get duller and even darker than before. Amber does change over time. It oxidizes. It's even affected by people's breathing. And we have quite heavy visitor traffic here in the amber room. But if you take care of it properly, which is what we do, every week one of our specialists comes to check up on it. Every 2 years we restore the coat of wax on the surface of the mosaics. Given these precautions, I believe it will remain a sight to behold and continue to impress visitors to the Catherine Palace.
Hidden deep in Oranienbaum Park stands the delicate and whimsical Chinese palace. It's like a dream of the East that's been shaped by the West. So let's step inside. Unlike the grand ceremonial palaces of Catherine's reign, this one feels a lot more secluded, hidden away. Why did Empress Catherine II choose this place as her residence?
Oranienbaum was the summer residence of Catherine's husband, the future Emperor Peter III. So you can't say she originally chose this place. She wanted to create a world of her own, here as a counterweight to what her husband was doing, because they weren't really on what you'd call good terms. She bought land from the Galitzin princes here in Oranienbaum to the west of the Oranienbaum estate, and started work on a garden, a palace, and a slide for sled riding, which existed here as well. She invested a lot of effort and ideas, a lot of her own creativity, and after doing so much, she must have developed an affinity for this place, not because she chose it, but because she worked so hard on developing it.
I'm sure she must have also found some solitude here, but I guess she must have spent a lot of her free time here as well. How would Catherine let her hair down?
For Catherine, Oranienbaum was more than just a residence that she created and her first genuine residence in Russia. It was also a place that she would revisit again and again after becoming empress. Even as an older, wiser woman who had grandchildren, she still kept coming back to revisit the world of her youth.
Right.
Perhaps she wanted to remember the time when she didn't yet wield such power and didn't have the burden of so much responsibility on her shoulders. She would return to a world where she was always young and beautiful, where she could let her hair down, which is maybe why Oranienbaum was so dear to her.
So she could take her mask off.
Yes, exactly.
The interiors are full of Chinese porcelain. How did these genuine Chinese artifacts end up all the way in the residence of a Russian empress in the 18th century?
To begin with, St. Petersburg is not very far from here. There was a port that received Chinese goods shipped via Europe. They were very expensive, of course. Russia and China had another trading route, however, because Russia borders China in the east. So there was a land route known as the Siberian Road. It included both roads and inland waterways. Under Catherine II, the Siberian Road, which initially terminated in Moscow and was extended to St. Petersburg, the extension was known as the Catherine Road.
Right. Fascinating. And what was this fascination with Chinese aesthetics? Was it just a fleeting trend, or was the environment here so different that it allowed Ekaterina to take a rest from the outside world?
Yes, you could say that. Both, I believe. The palace prominently features Chinese aesthetics as interpreted by Europeans, the so-called chinoiserie. It has many Chinese-inspired elements. Catherine, who corresponded with the likes of Rousseau and Voltaire, was also very much into Chinese philosophy. So it's not just about looks. There was a solid ideological foundation underneath it all as well. Still, as the Russian Empress, she couldn't spend too much time on those matters. And this palace became an embodiment of new trends and a European take on Chinese art.
Well, the parquet floors of the Chinese palace are also considered to be true works of art, both in terms of their craftsmanship, the design, the materials used. They're really quite unique in the world. How are they made?
The parquet floors were not part of the original design of the palaces as conceived by architect Antonio Rinaldi. As an Italian, he had a vision for something like an Italian palazzo with some chinoiserie elements. So the floors were made of faux marble. Unfortunately, those floors didn't survive. After just 6 years, they were in such a poor condition that new floors made of a different material were necessary. That's how these beautiful parquet floors came about. They are made of more than 20 types of wood, including both trees that grow in Russia and Europe, as well as those that had to be imported from South America, Africa, and Asia, including China. Imported wood was so expensive that only thin sheets of veneer were used. The foundation of these floors is made up of wooden panels, and glued onto them are veneer shapes cut from different types of wood. What you see is a natural palette of different woods. Dyes, namely copper sulfate, were only used as an exception to obtain a greenish leafy tint or soot-like elements. Those bits of wood would be soaked in copper sulfate. Apart from that, a different technique was used when a cutout element was placed inside hot sand to bake for a while. The layers that got the most heat would acquire a darker shade, and the whole piece would become a soft gradient of brown hues from dark to light, and finally engraving. You can see it here. Grooves were cut into the wooden surface to later be filled with a special substance that got darker when it contacted with wood, thus creating a three-dimensional pattern. This work was performed by a whole team of artisans, led by the cabinet makers Peterson and Jacob Lang, who replaced the faux marble floors with parquet, hall after hall.
So you mentioned something quite interesting there, that some of this wood has come all the way from Africa and South America. What are the most exotic types of wood, and how did they end up all the way in Russia?
The practice of using precious types of wood was quite common in Europe. They had distinctive colors and textures. You can see that some of the woods here have a pretty dense color or a pattern of stripes on the surface. Woodworkers used those unique features expertly for artistic effect. Catherine wanted something extraordinary for her palace, so she had wood brought all the way from Latin America, Africa, and Asia. It was valuable not only because it came from such remote places, but also because of sandalwood trees, for example, that grow very slowly. You had to wait for decades before you could use it for cabinetry. Thus, sandalwood was very expensive. There was also rosewood with its unmistakable pattern of pink stripes on a lighter background, of jacaranda wood from Brazil. More than 20 types of wood were used.
I know that often in these old estates and palaces, the floors hold secrets themselves. You can often find hidden notes or artifacts. Have you made any unusual discoveries here?
When the floor panels were removed for restoration, several objects were found. One of them was a little clay candlestick that must have been used by the craftsmen who worked on these floors. They needed light, so they used those little candlesticks. Another find, which was very unexpected and important for us, was a message from the restorers who worked in 1962. They restored the parquet in one of the rooms.
It's like a time capsule.
Yes.
Yelena, we're in the glass beaded salon. Now, it's considered to be one of the crown jewels of this entire palace. Now, the glass here, it's not carved or painted. It's made up of thousands of tiny little glass beads that are embroidered into the panels. Do we know exactly how many were used in the process?
There are more than 2 million of them. It's impossible, of course, to count all the beads exactly. We can only come up with an approximate number, but even this estimate is impressive. This is a genuine 18th century creation, which is very well known in Russia. Since the Chinese palace survived the Great Patriotic War, in the 1940s, it was seen as a symbol of hope for the return of lost treasures. That's why these original works of art that were evacuated and survived are handled with even greater care and admiration, and restoration took longer than the original creation.
Rococo was the dominant style of the time, and it's often been described as theatrical. It's quite flamboyant. So could we say that the Chinese palace was not purely a residence, but also a stage of sorts?
The Chinese palace with its surrounding park was a stage of sorts. The alleys, which formed a green maze back then, didn't lead straight to the palace. There was an element of surprise as the guests didn't see the palace on approach. The palace looks very modest on the outside, so nobody expected it to be so sumptuous on the inside as it was. The architect, Antonio Rinaldi, who also designed the interiors, naturally worked in very close contact with Catherine, making each room look different from the rest. Again, it's like scene changes in the theater, so that the impressed guests would keep getting new impressions. The palace was used, among other things, for receptions where Catherine enjoyed playing the host and showcased the palace as her brainchild. The Chinese bedroom, by the way, was initially adorned with silk wall coverings in solid pink. After everything was completed, Catherine decided she didn't like the look of them, so they were replaced with painted Chinese-style silks. So you could argue it was something like a theater stage in Catherine's court.
Well, I've spotted another room out of the corner of my eye. Can we take a closer look? In the 18th century, China wasn't exactly the most accessible of countries. You couldn't exactly get on a plane and go there. So where did Russians and Europeans at the time get their idea about what China looked like?
China was a remote land of fairy tales, and most Europeans or Russians had a very limited idea of what it was like, based on what scant information was available to them. Everyone thought China was some kind of a magical country with an entirely different culture. People imagined China to have some magical properties and philosophy. The Europeans' mentality was entirely different, and they thought China was a place that was full of bliss, joy, and harmony between man and nature.
Are there any hidden symbols or elements that have been woven into the fabric of the interiors here, something that would be invisible to the untrained eye?
If there were any hidden messages for prosperity we haven't quite deciphered them yet. However, the 18th century was an age of allegory, which was used a lot in paintings and other works of art. The ceilings of the palace were quite symbolic. The painting on the ceiling of the large Chinese cabinet, where we are right now, is called A Union Between Europe and Asia. The bride here represents Europe, while the groom symbolizes China.